Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, and welcome back to Textory. Another episode, another slay. I don't know. I don't think that's what people say anymore. Before we jump into it, don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textory for text-related stuff and not related stuff that I find cool. And just if you want to support this podcast, make sure it is still going, because we don't get that many sponsors, let me be honest with you. Go and head to that Patreon and check it out. Maybe you'll find something you like there. So today, maybe you're a bit confused by today's episode's title, because I don't think it's a word that we use anymore. But before we actually get into the text, let's discuss the surrounding context. So I find it really interesting how things that were extremely popular in the past, that were sort of staples of culture, they just sort of fall into obscurity. You know, there is TV series that our parents were obsessed with that we don't even know about, we don't even remember, we don't care. There is products that people in the past have used and everyone knew what they were, and now we're not even familiar with them. There is popular magazines that were discontinued and we sort of just forgot about them. There's all those cultural resets and staples that we just don't know about because of the passage of time. And one of those once popular but then very obscure things was Little Blue Books. That was a thing that was popular in the 1920s and 1930s mostly. They were started by Emanuel Haldeman Julius and his wife Marcette. They sort of wanted to publish small pocketbooks that could be read by the working class. So they were imagining someone during commute or on a break, they could just reach into their pockets and the books would be small enough to actually fit in someone's pocket. And then they could read. It could either be short pieces of literature, or it would be texts about particular ideas or things or science. The books started out in 1919, and it was first served as subscription-based service. So you only paid once and you received 50 little books. They had sort of various names at first, the series, but then in 1923, they finally stuck to Little Blue Books. I think what's cool about the Little Books was that they weren't just books. And marketing-wise, they did a very smart thing where you didn't have to go to a bookstore to get them. You could find them anywhere. You could find them in a drugstore. You could find them at a gas station. There would be stands in a toy store, or you could order by mail. So they were basically those novelty items with very catchy, interesting titles that you could maybe also collect or just grab when you're on a run somewhere. Honestly, genius. I feel like this could do well nowadays, but I don't think we can print them for that cheap of a price anymore. And you know, the fact that the books covered both classic literature like Shakespeare and Goethe, and then they also covered controversial topics at the time, such as homosexuality or atheism. I find it so intriguing how, you know, they found this niche and they just went with it. So unfortunately, as everything that's a little too progressive, they got struck down eventually. So Emmanuel and his wife were apparently a little too forward-thinking for the post-war America, and the books thrived in the 20s and 30s, but after the war, the FBI was like, this is suspiciously progressive, so let's investigate the books for including forbidden themes. So all in all, just the idea of books published specifically for the working class just smelled a little socialist at the time. So they convicted Emmanuel actually for something completely else, like tax evasion or something. But the publishing company was eventually sold and the book's popularity waned pretty fast. And nowadays, I don't think many people even remember them because they were popular so long ago. So this whole intro happened because today we are reading one of those little blue books, one that was published in 1926, and this one is called How to Win a Mate, The Art of Courtship. It was written by Clement Wood, who, interestingly, here is a little fun tidbit, he actually married another writer for the little blue books, Gloria Goddard, so they both kind of had the same job, even though I don't think the writers actually, you know, like sat in an office together. I think they were just hired for those little texts, or maybe they submitted the text. But either way, both him and his wife were writers for the little blue books. This book is obviously this man's very subjective tips and opinions. But I find it so interesting that because it was published as a little blue book, which was already quite a progressive series, it is quite bold and it's not as conservative as you would expect from a 1920s guide to, you know, flirting and building relationships. So let's dive into it then. The origin of wooing. The normal man must woo the woman who attracts him because of an instinct planted deep in his nature, which had its origin far down in the scale of life. The modern civilized woman must woo because this obligation has been laid upon her by man's rearrangement of society, dating from the savage hour when he ended the era of woman rule, the matriarchate, and took the leadership himself. See, even this statement that the man must pursue women because he's attracted to them biologically, but the woman must pursue the man because that's what the society made her do, that's a hot take for a 1926 book. If the boy or young man continues uninterested in girls, this is a bad sign. It may be bashfulness. We will take up that symptom and its cure later. It may indicate some inner twist which makes him prefer his own company or that of members of his own sex to female company. Okay, gay mentions. I mean, every time homosexuality is mentioned in old texts, regardless of the tone, which usually obviously is negative, I'm like still surprised that I even touched on that topic because it was so sensitive, as it still is nowadays for some reason, but that I'm always kind of surprised that they just talk about it casually. It happened also in one of the books that we read last season about women and men that other women and men should not marry, and there was a mention of lesbianism. That one was actually quite understanding. It was like, well, you're not going to want to force a lesbian to marry a man because neither of the married parties are going to be happy about that. So I'm always like so surprised that even in those times, they seem to have maybe even more compassion than some people do nowadays. And they sort of understand that it's a thing that happens and, you know, you don't have to pretend it's not. Anyway, there is an alarm going off behind my window, so I'm going to wait it out and then continue. It's still going. That's great. Okay, several hours later and we are so back. Anyway, let's get back to reading the text. Today, contrary to the custom in the subhuman world and among the earliest savage men, women must woo as well as men. The reason lies in men's alteration of the standards of society. What does that mean? But even the wise woman today realizes that the whole social arrangement of mating between the sexes is overcast with absurd taboos and restrictions, and that if she is to mate happily, she must regain part of woman's lost privilege of choice. There is nothing unladylike in her doing the choosing, in her unostentatious wooing, and if necessary, in her proposing marriage herself. We will take up woman as a wooer later. This is fascinating. So he's like, she might as well propose. I don't see anything wrong with that. Which for 1926 is a pretty hot take. The man comes to adolescence without any knowledge of woman, beyond his slight information concerning his mother and his sisters, if he has any, and casual contacts with other girls and women. The girl comes to adolescence as ill-informed. Yet soon thereafter, man and girl are called upon to enter, without preliminary training, the game or gamble of securing a life mate who will lift them up or drag them down thereafter in all of their efforts. Socially, this is a crime. Oop! That is a brutal read of the 1920s marriage scene. He means that there was little occasion to actually get to know each other before marriage, and that it made no sense to expect of people basically being able to pick well when it comes to a life partner if they never had any previous experience with the opposite sex. The only thing that can partially supply the lack of information today is the wooing period. Keep in mind then that the wooing period is primarily a time for learning about the other sex and its traits and eccentricities. The young man or woman in love should study the subject from books and from living teachers as amply as possible, and should observe other men and women, unmarried and married. This is actually not a bad tip. Like, if you don't have much experience in relationships, just observe what others are doing. I mean, maybe you'll find things you like, maybe you'll see things that you dislike, and that's how you will know that you don't want that. That's a good tip, to be honest, especially in 1920s when your dating pool was very limited and all you could do was just stare at others. When should one woo and marry? Are early or late marriages advisable? Here, society's present financial arrangement comes in. Unless the man or woman is wealthy already, and few are, the man cannot afford to support a wife in professional or white-collared business life until he is from 25 to 30. Marriage on a very small income may work out successfully. In the majority of cases, it does not. The girl who marries at 18 has hardly had time to know her own mind yet. There are arguments for waiting until she is 22 to 25, or even older. This is something that I've noticed in a lot of historical texts. Most people, at least on paper, were against early marriage. It was considered irresponsible, it was considered too hasty, it was considered financially unstable. So apart from maybe being able to produce an heir, it wasn't really considered a good choice to get married early. Early as in like late teens, let's say. The former conception was that the man was supposed to be the intellectual one by training and by contact with the broadening influences of his work and of the world of men, and that the woman should be an intellectual weakling. Woman is no longer forbidden an education. The ideal mating is where the man and woman are equally interested and intelligent in the business welfare, and are, in effect, partners, as they must be in results. Again, this is kind of a good tip. Like, I think intellectually, if you're on the same level, it's so much easier to build a real partnership, because if one does not really think like the other, maybe that could be an issue. I'm not saying that it's impossible, but it probably makes things easier when you can communicate with your partner sort of on the same level. It's also interesting that that was not the case before, because women were just not expected to be smart or educated. So it was perhaps a new take to seek a partner who's intellectually similar to you or has similar intellectual interests, let's say. Should a girl marry only a man well able to support her? Should a man marry only a girl who is well off financially? These questions would be absurd if current standards of society did not let them largely dictate many of the most unhappy marriages among us. One should marry for love, primarily and almost entirely. Again, this is a pretty fresh take for 1920s, because even though Victorians liked writing about love and Edwardians also enjoyed their love stories, in the society there was definitely this idea that marriage was mostly just a very profitable contract that you had to fulfill. And I mean, no wonder, because it was a tough time for people, but it definitely did not seem the most important thing to be in love with your marriage partner. Whereas here, he's like, only marry for love. Of all errors achieved in mating, perhaps marrying to reform a man is the worst. If a man cannot overcome his pet vices during the courting period, when he is free to fight the battle out within himself, it is almost a sure bet he will not alter after marriage. This is something that modern dating advice says a lot. Do not go for someone's potential. I can change him. No, you can't. Okay, this I was a bit confused about because I had no idea what he means, but it becomes clear pretty fast that he's talking about premarital sex. Should a man be married who has sowed his wild oats? Or should a girl insist upon the man's coming to the mating pure? Should a girl be married who has sowed her wild oats? Or should a man insist upon her coming to the mating pure? The average answer is that the man is the gainer by the sowing of wild oats, and that the girl is ruined by the practice. Needless to say, this angle of judgment is all wrong. The object of life is to achieve happiness. The chief method of gaining this is by experiencing the world. Love experience is no more harmful, unless pregnancy results, than experience in sampling different food menus. To me, this is shockingly a modern take for a booklet, a random booklet from 1926. No wonder the US government was like, what exactly are they writing in those books? Because, you know, the Hays Code is still a thing. We don't want people to go a bit too crazy. So what's going on exactly in the books? Should we be worried about that? And judging by this, yeah, maybe you should, because these are honestly such modern views for someone from 1926 that it definitely was not in line with the conservative way the US government was looking at things at the time. In general, the man is better off for having sowed some wild oats before marriage. He is less liable to plow a field of postmarital wild oats. The same is true, although in a slightly less degree, of the girl. The only difference is caused by the weight of social standards upon the two sexes today. Oh my god, he's talking about social standards. This man is so aware of what's happening here. Is love at first sight a possibility? Of course. And a frequent one. The normal man falls in love at first sight with every attractive woman he sees. Many a woman falls in love at first sight with a man who satisfies her ideal, hitherto unrealized. If both feel the emotion simultaneously, we have the perfect case. The subsequent wooing will indicate whether this is enduring love or an illusion. Should a man or woman woo several persons at once? In general, especially in the earlier stages of the wooing, this is an advantage. If you wish to buy a jewel, you are wise if you examine several before making your final choice. The same applies to wooing for a mate. Again, casual dating, pretty modern sounding, but I think dating in the past, especially in like early 20th century, was way more casual than people realize. I think we tend to think they didn't date at all. And now it's a helicopter. Oh my god, what's going on today? Whereas they actually did, and they in most cases they saw several people at once, and it was super casual, and there were no attachments, nobody cared. It was more like flirting, just casual flirting, really. Now, there is a whole chapter called How a Man Woos, which is supposed to describe, you know, the methods of wooing as a man. There is a paragraph that I can only describe as talking about getting the ick. He tells a story. 6 months ago, a girl whom I know met a young man of good family, fairly well-to-do, fairly educated, a couple of college degrees, I think, and a man who had traveled rather extensively in Europe and South America. He played a good hand of bridge, was interested in the same artistic things that the girl was, and was smitten with her from the first. After playing around with him for a couple of months, she refused to see him thereafter, except in a large party, and absolutely refused to let him court her further. The reason can be gathered from this typical specimen of his conversation. And now is a quote. I was at a club, see? A lot of the fellows were there, see? And we decided to shoot a little bridge, see? On the very first hand, see? I had four honors in diamonds and I bid two diamonds, see? Tactfully, the girl had pointed out that the constantly reiterated C just was not done by literate people. The man could not or would not change it. And yet that small irksome trait was what cost him the girl he wanted. This is too real. There is something about first impressions that is probably the reason why we tend to refuse people so early on, because we just can't get past those little things. And if you really like someone, you should be able to ignore their small imperfections like these, or you would just find them endearing at some point. But if it's not meant to be, it's not meant to be. I don't know what to tell you. I don't think that was solely the reason for her refusal in this case. And then there's talk about physical love. You will want, and she will expect, some physical love from the start. Among different strata of society, customs as to kissing and caressing differ. Never give the girl less than she expects. After you have found out that she likes to be kissed, you will disappoint her permanently if you give her the sort of kiss you would give dear old Aunt Tabby, aged 98 in the shade. Yet remember to think of her wishes primarily. Don't give her the sort of kisses you want first, but the kind that she wants. Your artistry will come in subtly leading her to want things that you want. This is a short lesson on consent, I guess. Just listen to what she wants and make sure that you respect her wishes first. No sensible girl today wants the man to propose to her father or her parents before he proposes to her. After all, he is not marrying the father or the parents. He is marrying the girl. This is unusual because I suspected in the 1920s that was still a pretty popular thing to do, to ask the father or the parents for their permission to propose. But maybe that was just after the engagement was already set in stone. You would just be like, hey, so can we get married? But that was after you asked her, I guess. I don't know. Okay, this aged pretty badly. Don't study a book of etiquette as to how to propose. The more stilted and formal a proposal is, the easier it is for the girl to laugh at the ridiculousness of the situation. Real lovers know, without the words having been said, that their equivalent in deeds has been achieved. Even a slang proposal. Well, honey, shall we hit it off together? May be far more effective than, may I have the honor of making you my wife? Be natural in this, unless you have ascertained that the girl desires the frills. In that case, give her what she desires. It's funny because I have noticed, watching classic Hollywood movies, how casual they were with the proposals. Like, you would just be talking to your guy friend and he would be, say, why don't we get married? And then the girl's like, you've asked me 10 times. No, Tom, it's not happening. But then they still continue to be friends. So clearly, they didn't look at it as this major lifelong commitment, but it was more like, why not? We might as well die. I mean, which is actually very counterintuitive, because marriage to them was probably much more serious than it is to us today. It was, you know, the social expectations of having to stay together even when everything's falling apart. In general, people probably stayed more committed in those marriages at that time. And yet the way those marriages started, if you ask your grandparents, a lot of the time it was like, yeah, I didn't really like him, but then he asked me like 10 times, so I said yes. Or, yeah, he was nice, he was the nicest boy in the village. But it's never those grand love stories and massive proposals and huge weddings. At least in case of my ancestors and my family, it was like, I don't think anyone remembers even what went down. And yet those people stayed together till the end of their days. And I think it's, maybe it's telling us something, I don't know. Let's listen to what this guy has to say. The real lover, man or woman, continues the courtship as long as the mating lasts. All that has been said about making oneself attractive in the eyes of the other applies with a special force to this wooing after marriage. Do your best to make a success of the mating. If your efforts fail and a separation or divorce is necessary, you can never reproach yourself afterwards with the accusation that you did not try your best. Then we have a chapter about how a woman woos. Most textbooks on wooing and courtship devote their space allotted to women's wooing to such absurd devices as flirtation by parasol, fan, glove, handkerchief, dining table signals, window flirtation, and flower flirtation. The number of people who read such silly books is limited. The number among these who remember what they have read is far smaller, and perhaps no men are included in the latter number. Thus, no man will understand what your signals mean. If you... That is so true. You have all those parasol signs and secret love languages, but how would people even know if they didn't read the same books? A few of the choice instructions given are as follows. Parasol flirtations. Carrying it elevated in left hand, desiring acquaintance. Carrying it closed in left hand, meet on the first crossing. Carrying it closed in right hand by the side, follow me. Closing it up, I want to speak to you, love. Swinging to and fro on the handle on right side, I am married. With handle to lips, kiss me. So these are all the secret parasol signs, supposedly, that he's quoting. But then he says, the trouble is, all women must carry their parasols somehow, and in more than 9 cases out of 10, they have no faintest dream of these so-called signals. If you ignore them and they are intended, you insult the lady. If you act on them, as for instance, stepping up and kissing a stranger who has nervously brought the handle of her parasol to her lips, you are liable to be fined $750 in Pennsylvania, $2,500 in New York State, and a vast sum of $1.15 in New Jersey. That is actually very true, because how would you know that the lady is using the secret fan or parasol language and not just looking at you while doing something, while fidgeting with her parasol? This is a risky business to be involved with. Should a girl woo when she is convinced that the man is worthy to be her mate? There is no reason in the world why she should not. Her wooing should, as a rule, be less obtrusive and more subtle than a man's. But once having decided that she desires a man for a mate, she should use every method of proving herself his invaluable companion, a campaign that the men should use in a similar situation. The old-fashioned training of girls developed them into nice girls, with Victorian prejudices, ignorant of everything essential to life. The pendulum has swung to the other extreme. The modern generation of Petters and Neckers, who have the forefront of today's picture, are the very reverse of this. So he's talking about something that we have discussed before in our episodes about 1950s dating, which is the petting and the necking. So basically, physical love that is not too sexual, but it also kind of is sexual. But it was still within the norms of society to be doing that. But it was also a little scandalous. It's difficult. Just get back to that episode. I think that was season one. And hear for yourself what I was talking about. Unless you desire your man to continue to divide womankind into two classes, nice women like his wife, to whom he may not tell a clever risk story, whom he will love physically only in a nice way, and the other type of women, to whom he probably will turn sooner or later, and thereafter increasingly, for the solid human comfort of utter physical mating, unless you wish your husband to share his physical love with less worthy and more human women, you had best get over your niceness as soon as possible and graduate into the class of human beings. This one has left me slightly confused, but I think in general he means to not pretend to be timid and just show your real character. But the way he says it is he threatens the women that their husbands are gonna cheat on them. So this is not nice. If a girl has had a normal rearing, she will not make the mistake of thinking that the Puritans were right, that bodies end at the neck and at the shoe tops with nothing between. So again, he's like encouraging women to maybe embrace their sexuality, but the way he does that is a little offensive, because he's like, if you're not gonna give it to him, he's gonna find it somewhere else. Moving on to engagements. Should an engagement be short or long? What is the proper length for the happiness of the parties involved? Especially in old-fashioned country districts, long engagements are often known and laughed at. Okay, that's interesting. Long engagements are not wise. If the two are separated by distance, if, for instance, the young man goes to the city to make his financial way so that marriage is possible, there is strong chance that either he or she will find a more suitable mate. In such cases, if the original engagement is carried out, happiness is almost inevitable, and the breaking of the engagement may bring unhappiness to at least one of the parties concerned. I have a feeling there is something here said about long-distance relationships, but I don't really understand what he's saying here. So if two are separated by distance, so the guy goes off to the city to make money, there is a strong chance that they will find a more suitable mate. But then if the original engagement is carried out, happiness is almost inevitable. So what is he saying? Should they stay together or shouldn't they? I think the takeaway from this is long engagements are not wise, right? But then he says, too brief engagements are at times more dangerous. This is especially true where the man and girl have not known each other before. The wisest thing, and this kind of changes my perspective on the way he saw short and long engagements, the wisest thing is to let the engagement last a month or longer. And then, if the mating is desired, take the plunge even on a moderate income, then risk the danger of letting the engagement become a tedious habit. I thought when he said short engagements, he meant like, half a year. But he's like, listen, engagement should be at least a month, which makes me think, what was he referring to as brief engagements? Was that like a week? What is he talking about? Anyway, he ends by saying, when you have made yourself an artist in wooing, both in theory and practice, do not be stingy with your lore, but pass it on to other men and women who lack it. For only the great in love are great in life and great in joy. Okay, this is a cute little phrase for the end of this text. What do you guys think? I think in many ways I was surprised at how modern sounding this little booklet was, because I don't know, there's things in old books, especially regarding relationships between people, that often sound very outdated, and you know, their priorities were completely different from our priorities. So then you read something like that and you're like, wait, this is actually not stupid. A lot of that stuff is obviously, you can tell it was written by a man in the 1920s, but then a lot of the stuff, I'm like, was that sort of a common consensus, or was that just his original unique views that he then featured in this little booklet? Because it's difficult to tell where his views ended and where the views of the contemporaries started. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? I mean, there are certain views that were probably held by most in that generation, and yet he still sounds like he probably thought things differently than them. I am a bit torn between this vision of like the roaring 20s with the flappers and rouged knees and all that stuff, because that definitely did happen, and there was a massive sort of societal revolution surrounding those sort of sensitivities. But also at the same time, there was still this notion of a woman being sort of a stay-at-home carer of the house, maybe not as involved in the workplace as the men were, maybe not being as politically active. And that was slowly shifting, but still, I think, even compared to after-war booklets on similar topics, that is quite surprising. Or maybe it's just me having a completely wrong notion of what people thought in the 1920s, but basing it on the other things that I have read from the era, I do find it quite surprising how progressive that was. So that was it for this episode. As always, let me know what you thought, and don't forget to check out the Patreon at patreon.com/textree, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!